Hi, my name's Noreen Jamil, and this is...
Emily Kate Stevens.
Both of us have been diagnosed with long COVID.
And we've created this podcast dedicated to the condition. Welcome to the Long COVID Sessions. Hello, love.
Hi, sweetie.
How are you doing? How was your week?
I'm having an Emily week because I kind of feel okay today. So I'm feeling like I had a good week, but I'm sure I didn't.
blocking out all the crap.
So I had a couple of weeks of really bad back and side, if you remember.
Yeah.
And no one could really figure it out. I went to the doctor. I had a whole lot of blood work done. Awesome GP. I want to just give her a shout out. I won't name her. She's great because I walk in and she's really receptive to what I'm saying. So I said, look, I've got this pain, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, well, okay, let's do some blood tests. And I added a few extra, you know, why don't we do this and this and this? They all came back fine.
Yeah.
And I have a scan right side for all the organs. So spleen, kidneys, liver. I'm sure it'll take a month or two. But the blood work was reassuring and the pain is gone.
Okay.
But what I thought it might have been was my blood pressure meds. So I stopped taking them for a few days and the pain went away, okay. But my blood pressure shot up. So then I started taking them again.
It's just finding this balance between the side effects of things and what you actually need to keep certain things in check, isn't it?
Yeah. Walking a tightrope, aren't we, most days?
Am I right in saying that you'd been taking colchicine to...
I did, and then you informed me that it kills my T cells. So I was like, okay, I better stop that because my T cells are in the toilet anyway. So I only took it for a couple of days.
I just read a couple of studies on its impact on the T cells.
You are my consultant, so I do have to listen to you.
Interestingly, the inflammation for you, though, does not just feel like it's in the organs, does it? Your creepy crawly feeling in your ear. That's all down the same side, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I find that I have all the things down the left side. That is apparently quite common when you're experiencing pain or recurring symptoms.
You know, when I look all the way back to when we first got sick, and actually even before I knew I had long COVID, I did book an appointment to go and see my GP because I honestly thought I had a spider in my ear.
Yeah.
It's that kind of feeling, like something's walking around in there. It's not tinnitus, as you would expect a kind of a sound. It's a feeling that something's in there. And she was so dismissive, she just kind of shoved her ear-peering thing down my ear and was like, there's nothing in there, off you jog.
But that's the case with tinnitus as well, isn't it? People just say, well, it's nothing. But actually, what you're describing and the likely pathway of tinnitus is... nerves. So that is a neurological, like the nerve sensation in your ear.
And it does get worse when I'm not well.
When you're having a flare.
Or it's also a precursor to a flare. Because sometimes it does actually go away.
That's true. And wasn't that the first sign, again, this time before you got this right side inflammation?
Yeah. And the right side inflammation, I've had it twice previously. This time was so much worse.
Really?
It was really painful.
Does that mean that you've been able to exercise, run and keep up that side of things, or has it stopped you doing those things?
It's stopped me not because I physically think I can't do it, partly have stopped because I was feeling unwell and know that when you feel unwell, you need to pace because otherwise things can get worse. And I didn't want things to kind of move to my heart, which they often do if I push myself, right? I'm really conscious of that. I'm feeling unwell. I don't have any shame about just sitting on the sofa.
Which is kind of the opposite to the way that I operate, isn't it?
Yeah. Looking back over the last 6 months, I do feel that you've had more crashes than I have.
Yeah, definitely in the last 6 months.
Not to say I haven't seen massive improvements in you, but if I were to generalise and compare and contrast between us,
yeah,
I'd say you've had definitely more significant crashes than I've had.
Yeah.
Because we often don't tell each other now, when we're having mini crash, like if we're feeling really crappy one day, we just
get on with it.
The text will be, I'm fine. Or,
fine.
I'm
we're
okay.
Always fine, aren't we?
Yeah.
That's like code for I'm pretty bad, but I really can't face actually acknowledging it. I think from my perspective, it's just, I just get on with it now.
Yeah. I mean, the biggest sign for me when you're not well is when...
Just go silent?
When you just go silent, yeah.
That's what I do to everyone.
And I'm sure that I'm probably one of your first texts when you're coming through the other side. But I also know to leave you alone. Like, if I haven't heard from you, because you just don't want to deal with anything.
I think the thing is that if I... It's not that I always have to be a positive influence on people's lives, but I just don't like bringing my darkness to other people, really. So that's why I just go into my hole and stay there for a while.
That's very altruistic of you. With me, when I feel really shit and kind of don't speak to people, it's because I really can't be asked to talk to anyone. And how was your week, my love?
I had probably the worst migraine crash that I've had in 6 months or something. I actually thought I was having a brain aneurysm. I was in so much pain. And it was this sort of 3 or 4 day thing, quite severe headaches. But then by Saturday, it was hell. The kind of pain that you can't actually move to actually get the painkillers. Anyway, I came through that. And what I've done is I've then just hit life really hard, which is completely the opposite of what I'm supposed to do, I'm sure. But I think I was so knocked by quite how bad I was feeling that now that I felt okay, I felt like going out and living my life. So I've actually been out socializing quite a lot. I've been running around trying to do all the things that I couldn't do in those 4 or 5 days when I was sick, then catching up with myself. And I know everyone would say, this is the antithesis to pacing. This is the opposite of what you should be doing. But at the same time, it's made me really happy. I've really, really enjoyed seeing friends and seeing people and being out. And I went to the theatre. And so what I get from that, from sort of feeding my soul or my energy like that, it makes it worth it for me. But that's it, always how I do it, isn't it?
Yeah. But it works. Like, I mean, it works. The only worry for me is that we do this, or you do this more than I do. Because I tend to be okay with, and I'm also less social than you, to be honest. But I'm worried what impact it's going to have down the road.
I always think of that when I'm like, oh, I'm hitting it really hard, or I'm really slightly pushing it. I think Noreen's going to be thinking, what are the long-term impacts that you're doing to your health because of that ME/CFS knowledge that we have? But honestly, I would prefer to be happy in the moment. I mean, obviously, that's a really short-sighted and terrible thing to say for my children. But I'm enjoying myself. As you can hear, I might have got a slight cold, which is probably, is it not, what the massive 5-day crash was that prelude to me fighting some kind of virus? Perhaps. Is that what our immune systems are doing?
I don't know if the timeline works, but I agree with you in principle 100% that once we're fighting something, even if we don't know we're fighting something, it manifests in our long COVID.
Yeah, and the body just fighting to kick that out.
My kids have come home sick this week, definitely with some kind of viral thing, but I've seemed to have escaped it, and yet I know my immune system is actually in the toilet.
Yeah. No, I guess this week is someone who possibly thinks that he can explain that conundrum of the immune system's inability to respond to certain things, or the immune system's failing when it comes to responding to virus.
He talks about the immunity gap.
Yeah.
But not in a way that is being used in the press. He's talking about how, if the theory of long COVID is viral persistence, then a gap in our body's effective antibodies makes it more likely to develop long COVID because we're unable to clear the virus. And his technology can measure that, quantify it.
Yeah. So it's Professor Andrew Shaw, and he's from Exeter University, but is CEO and founder of a company called Atomarker, who's developed this nanotechnology test, which theoretically should be able to show what that immunity gap is, and therefore almost why we have long COVID. And he says that it is a diagnostic test full on COVID and believes that he knows how to treat it. To get to this point of Atimarca that you are now, you have been working for some years. Am I right in thinking, looking at immunity testing? And I think I saw that you've done research into monoclonal antibodies as far back as 2014. I saw some papers from you. Is that right?
Yeah. So I had a vision in 2006 that we should invent a new basic technology. And it was a basic technology research council call that said, if you wanted to invent the new telescope, the new microscope, the new laser, what would you do? And I proposed to invent this technology that would measure multiple things in your blood simultaneously from a small volume. And we then set about designing that. We invented that in the laboratory. We filed some patents pretty quickly and then formed Atimarca. And since then, we've been struggling with the financial crisis, and that meant investment was tricky. But we've been evolving the technology to the point where it's now in three clinics around the world. There's a mail away service in the UK, and the handheld version of the technology will be available for use in the new year. So it's been an idea that has been a long time in the making and a long time in the germination, but it's now mature. It has three CE marks, and we are doing what I said, which is a multiplexed, multidimensional view of people's biomarkers.
Can I just ask the obvious question at this point? Did you have any problems because of what happened with Theranos?
Well done.
Well, we thought we should get that out of the way early on, because you're always asked about it, aren't you?
Yeah. If somebody hasn't asked that question within 11 minutes, I usually bring it up anyway. Theranos has been the elephant in the room ever since I set the technology up. And indeed, Elizabeth Holmes was at Stanford and she dropped out to set up Theranos. I was at Stanford for a while. Though I had a similar sort of background and people saw that in the comparison, but I was a postdoc at Stanford and I've published now more than 150 papers, and there are now 8 granted patents and 3 CE marks in the technology. So gloriously, she had a good idea, and I guess that's a common idea, but she just didn't have the technology. And she had more than enough money to have bought companies to do it. She had what she raised over $700 million. And rather fun, as a result of the FT article we did recently, somebody put a comment on the FT website saying, this is Elizabeth Holmes ringing from the prison payphone, saying, well done. So I'm hoping the Theranos elephant has now left the room and we are getting proper funding interest, and now we're getting proper data from the field.
I think it's just because of the similarities in what you're trying to do, right down to the way in which the blood is taken. And is this called nanophotonic? Is that what refers to taking such a small sample of blood and then the way that you assess it?
So the small volume of blood, I think we learned a lot from the pandemic in that we've learned to take finger pricks of blood accurately. It was validated very quickly. The lances that we use to take the finger prick go in a bit further than they used to. They make a bit bigger hole. And we've been able to correlate very nicely the concentration of molecules you get out of your finger prick with that in your arm. So we've learned that as a legacy technology from the pandemic. The nanophotonic bit is the sample flows over a series of gold nanoparticles on the surface of our technology. And the nanophotonics means the nanoparticle optics change. And it's that change that I measure when the blood chemistry goes over the surface. I choose it to be specific to a given target, like C-reactive protein or an antibody, for example. And then the biophotonics illuminates the test result for me without having to functionalize it. And so it becomes a very rapid way of imaging what the test result is going to be.
And is that different technology to what was testing our antibodies, that the antibody testing that came out around September 2020 that we were using for COVID antibodies of the active virus strain that we had just had? Is it similar technology?
So it's capturing the same molecule. So the measuring the antibody in your blood, it's doing the detection bit in a different way. So in the laboratory, they have a big instrument and they probably do the technique via a color change or a fluorescence change or an aggregation change. What I do is measure a brightness change, and that happens very quickly, and I can monitor that in 7 minutes or so. The other thing that is different is quickly we standardized our result against a NIST standard. And so I was able to tell you what the absolute concentration of antibodies was in your blood. And we spent some time looking to see whether there was a good level that was protective, why your levels of antibodies fell so quickly. And that led on to the long COVID test, because you can measure both the concentration and the quality. And the quality measure isn't done by anybody else, really.
So what are you using to do this long COVID test in terms of the markers there? Because obviously different strains of the COVID are producing different antibodies. What are you looking for that you say is able to give you a diagnostic test of long COVID?
What we do is measure the antibodies in your blood and how well they bind to the spike protein from 11 variants. So we take the 11 variants that were common, some at the beginning of the pandemic, pre-Omicron, and some post-Omicron, including the XB115 that's circulating this year. And we see how well your antibodies bind to all of those. And ideally, you'd like your antibody to stick to every one so that no particular variant would cause you a problem. Some people have that. So they have complete spectral coverage over the full spectral range of variants, and they're able to make good quality antibodies and in high concentration. And that's the sort of universal cover, universal endotype, phenotype that we've observed. But some people don't make antibodies. So one of my colleagues at work, for example, has good antibodies only to the early variants, so Wuhan, Beta, Delta, and nothing past Omicron at all. And that's very interesting. That says there's a gap on the spike protein to which you've made your antibodies. And that patch of the spike protein is no longer there in a different variant, in the new variants. And so your antibodies don't work. And so what we are looking at now is, have you made good quality antibodies across the spectrum? No. And where are the gaps? Simply, if your long COVID symptoms started with a Wuhan infection, for example, what are your Wuhan antibodies like? And we're seeing people that have got gaps in their antibody spectra specifically to the Wuhan variant. Some people have got gaps to the Delta variant. Some people have got gaps to the Omicron variant. And that leads to the idea that the antibodies are required to clear the virus from your body. If you don't have good antibodies, they don't stick to the virus and it hangs around. It's persisting. And so that's the diagnostic basis of our test.
But then that's assuming that long COVID is caused by a persistent virus.
That's the underlying hypothesis, yes. So if it were something other than that, so the infection is waking up Epstein-Barr virus, for example, that's latent in the body, or it's causing a dysregulated response in your immune system, which doesn't reset properly after infection, all of those are options. The hypothesis that we're testing is that you got your long COVID as a result of a COVID infection, which you didn't clear properly from your body.
And is your suggestion that we have this immunity debt innate in us, those of us that contract long COVID, rather than it being something that is caused by the COVID virus, somehow causing our immune system to not work properly?
When you get an infection, the cells become infected and the T cells mount a very good response and they then clear the infected cells. But when the infected cell levels begin to fall, the T cell concentration drops. What should happen then is there should be a good circulating, sterilizing serum of antibodies to go and mop up the bits of virus that aren't sitting inside an infected cell. And this, we think, is part of everything that happens in flu, in Epstein-Barr virus, or whatever infection you have. The sterilizing serum should go and clear up any virus particles that are not causing a cell to be sick. Occasionally, a virus particle will then enter a cell. Occasionally, a virus particle will sat between a cell and begin to recruit inflammation markers, recruit local inflammation. And that could be white blood cells, that could be cytokines, whatever. And that would then trigger the symptoms that are observed around the body. So microclotting, potentially, brain fog if the virus is in the brain, gut malfunction if the gut's not working properly. If it's persistent, this virus is, what, 90 nanometers in diameter? It's tiny. It can be everywhere. And unless it's cleared, it can cause microinflammatory responses. Once it's entered a cell, it then gets the full T-cell clearance process and it disappears. But that just means there's ongoing background microinflammation. So we've been offering the antibody spectrum test commercially under a named patient basis with a clinic in London called Recognition Health. And the theory in my mind has been, if you've got a poor antibody spectrum and there's a hole in your spectrum corresponding to the onset of your long COVID symptom, then we could treat the hole. We could fix the hole by giving you immunotherapy. So these are antibodies that were invented at the beginning of the pandemic. that work really well towards the early variants, so alpha, beta, gamma, delta, but not Omicron, because they were tuned against those variants. And we've treated one patient so far, but there are some other patients lining up. And he had a hole in his antibody spectrum at the Wuhan variant, where he had no good quality antibodies. So we then gave him the immunotherapy and filled the hole. And you can see that the antibodies were at high concentration in his blood, and we deliberately put the concentration up through three bouts of immunotherapy.
And is that three infusions?
Yeah, three injections. We also gave him Paxlovid on top, just in case the immunotherapy stirred up virus that caused an infection. So he had three Paxlovid and Evusheld injections. And we monitored the level of the antibodies, and it got up to well over 180 milligrams per litre compared to a vaccine response of around 30 on average. But interestingly, we also made some measurements inside his CSF. So we know those antibodies, because it has a spectral fingerprint, we know those antibodies got into his brain. So we were addressing things like his brain fog. And as a result of that, his migraine frequency went down from daily to less than one a month. And his gut function has recovered, and he flew off on holiday last week. But I don't think he's fully recovered from his long COVID, but he clearly had a benefit from the immunotherapy.
So it's not just patient-reported symptomatic relief. You can actually see that. Is that rerunning the same tests?
Yeah, so we can show that we plugged the gap. We can show that his antibody spectrum went from a spectrum that had a whole in the quality of his Wuhan antibodies to one that's now filled with the immunotherapy antibody at a very high concentration so that it perfused in from his blood into his brain. And we then saw the spectrum of that immunotherapy antibody in his cerebral spinal fluid as well.
So how many people have you been able to test with the ASO marker to see how many antibodies they have so we can know what the difference is between people who've got long COVID and people who don't?
So we've commercially sold about 35 tests. But as we speak in the lab today, we're doing a diagnostic accuracy study where we're going to take 50 long COVID patients, self-reported long COVID patients, but with symptoms that fit in with the WHO definition of long COVID, and 50 patients that have recovered from long COVID. And we're going to look at our antibody spectrum against those to do a diagnostic accuracy study. But what I expect to find is there'll be groups of patients where some of them have holes around the onset of the long COVID symptoms. So Wuhan hole, for example, around the onset of a Wuhan long COVID symptom. And then there'll be some that don't have holes around their variants. And I expect that's possibly because when you get sick, it maybe you invent your own personal mutant variant inside you, or that they were infected with a virus that they didn't know about. And so their long COVID symptoms started after their initial infection, for example.
So when you say hole, do you mean no antibodies at all or much less than another person who's created antibodies?
So we standardized against the cohort of teachers. Teachers got exposed to COVID a lot from kids at school. And we measured effectively a cohort of healthy responses. And we looked at the antibody quantity in those healthy responses, and we looked at the antibody quality in those healthy responses. And the antibody quality threshold we're using at the moment is the lower quartile of that distribution. But some, I mean, we looked at a long COVID kid recently, and some of them just got no high quality antibodies at all. Now, that may have been there beforehand. In other words, they don't make antibodies at all well, in which case they may have been a sickly child. But certainly in the case of the exposure to COVID, they didn't make good quality antibodies to any of the variants. And so we have seen people just with very, very poor spectra.
You've actually written a couple of papers, I believe, into the effects of the vaccine, not necessarily on long COVID, but on people's antibodies.
Yes, we did quite a number of studies now looking at how people's antibody spectra varied between the administrations of the two vaccines or two vaccine types. And you can see with double Pfizer-Pfizer, you get a very different endotype profile, a very different immune profile compared to, say, AstraZeneca-AstraZeneca-Pfizer. If you were vaccinated with AstraZeneca, double AstraZeneca and Pfizer, for example, then you would have been raising antibodies against the type of protein that was generated by the type of spike protein generated by that vaccine. If you made bad antibodies or something that was only good to Wuhan, but not good to Delta, for example, then You have something what's called original sin. If you start raising antibodies to a virus and then you see the virus again, you raise the same antibodies, you remember what they are. If you had a bad bio imprint, then you continue to make bad antibodies. But if the antibodies that you made didn't get rid of the virus, then you end up with a persistent virus. So in part, the vaccine was the problem. So one of my colleagues at work, she had a double AstraZeneca jab and had a very poor antibody spectrum. But when she had the Pfizer top up, she ended up with a full spectrum of good quality antibodies. Really a beautiful, complete spectrum.
Is that someone who had long COVID symptoms?
Just the product of Astra Pfizer. No infection at all. Simply the Pfizer doing a better job of making antibodies to the spike protein. All spike protein.
But the vaccine hasn't changed since the first iteration, hasn't it? Or the second iteration, the one that they did for Omicron. So
right. So it depends on what you express. When you get a messenger RNA vaccine, you take the message into your cells and then you build a spike protein. If you build that spike protein in a way that's slightly different from the presentation of the AstraZeneca protein, then you build new antibodies to that. And so I think there was a maturation of her antibodies against a better spike protein as a result of the Pfizer jab compared to the AstraZeneca jab. So we saw lots of problems with the AstraZeneca jab, which were cleared up by changing the vaccine, either to Moderna or Pfizer. And that's an interesting point, because I think if you're suffering from long COVID and you have a bad imprint, we might be able to repair your imprint by switching the vaccine.
That's interesting.
It got better for lots of people. We clearly got better at making antibodies after the first AstraZeneca vaccination. But then you add people's infection onto that. So why don't you make better antibodies when you get a natural infection? And it must change it a bit. But if you go back to your initial recipe and the initial recipe is bad, then you don't make good antibodies to it. So I would expect, and we've seen in some patients, a repeat regeneration of their immunobiomark so that they continue to make bad antibodies when the next infection happens.
Just to remind our listeners, once you have the vaccine, they talk about they were offering boosters every 6 months because antibodies go down naturally.
Yes.
How are you factoring that into your statistics?
The half-life of antibody concentrations, but somewhere between 60 days and 200 days, which is a big spread.
Yeah.
We look at what the quantity of the antibody is at the time, and that can be now quite low. But as long as there is some across the spectrum, we can see it. What we look at is the proportion of good quality antibodies, which in the case of the person who's got this universal response spectrum, 60% of our antibodies are good quality antibodies, which means they stick on the virus and will stay there for more than 2 hours, which is enough time for the body to then set about curing the virus. Whereas the low quality antibodies, a percentage of the antibodies you have, they don't last on the virus for very long at all. And so they just drop off and the virus is then not cleared.
I know my son had his antibodies tested a year after his initial infection, and I was told he had no antibodies whatsoever.
That's possible. All tests have a threshold. In other words, I can only see antibodies above a certain level.
Yeah.
But the ones in hospital have really low thresholds. So to say he has no antibodies at all, that might be an additional problem. Why is he not making antibodies? Does he make antibodies to the flu or to colds, for example? And I think understanding whether there's a background immunity problem around antibody production would be interesting. So I could do my exact spectrum test for the flu. I could look at H1N1, H5N1, and look at both the H and the N proteins and see whether you make good antibodies to those. And I think that could lead to long flu or indeed post-viral sequelae of any form. The Epstein-Barr is thought to cause ME. I could do the same spectrum test for the Epstein-Barr proteins.
But it's interesting, isn't it, that since COVID, we've seen a surge in people getting quite bad flu, both A and B, and the numbers have gone up.
We did miss a flu season with lockdown. So the fact that there was a complete, unexpectedly low level of flu. What we've done in the past is looked at the flu in Australia, the Southern Hemisphere, worked out what variants are circulating, worked out a vaccine, and exported it north for the winter. So we shuttle between the winters of the Northern and Southern Hemisphere. And for one season, that disappeared. And I wonder whether we're now out of phase. We don't know quite. Nothing was down there, so nothing's up here. And so now people are mixing again. We're getting a proper flu season. Last year, we had of order 140,000 flu cases. And that's more like normal. And maybe if we understand the variants better, then okay. Nobody knows why flu is seasonal. I asked this question once, and the best theory I could come up with is cold nose theory. If your nose is cold because you're breathing in cold air, the virus hangs around for a while, has a better chance of getting in. In the summer, it doesn't. You're outside more, obviously, and the air in your nose is. But nobody really knows why flu is seasonal. Is it just being inside? Don't know.
It's something to do with the immunity debt that the effect that COVID has had on our immune systems.
I've had COVID, twice now, and I've recovered nicely after each infection. And I don't think I have acquired any debt or any legacy from that process. And I think that must be true for a very large number of the population of the planet that's had COVID. I don't expect that if I then get the flu or the colds, my children bring home colds for me all the time from school. I don't think I'm suffering any particular adverse effect from that. I'm still shaking them off as well as I used to. If, however, I were to have had an underlying problem in making good quality antibodies, maybe that's just now more evident because the number of people with viral infections is much larger than it was. There are nearly 2 million people infected at the moment, according to Zoe. And that's really high in terms of viral load. Somebody told me that it's now the highest viral load since AIDS, since HIV. So it really is a significant health change.
Yeah.
But I think it's higher than hepatitis C. I think it's higher than HIV. So I think we are looking at something that's very strange.
And that's currently?
Yes.
That's the current viral load?
Yes.
Where we're supposedly out of the pandemic?
Yeah, so we still have these waves where a couple of million people are getting it. The number of people getting the flu each year is around 150,000. And we're looking at 10 times that for the current wave of COVID.
Yeah.
So the final part of the therapy for this person will be to give him a vaccine that's heterogeneous. That's different from the one he's had. He stopped at one AstraZeneca vaccine, I think, because he had an adverse effect to it. The idea is now that the virus is gone, we'll try and give him a vaccine that addresses the Omicron, the post-Omicron variant. So the new vaccines are bivalent, they work for Wuhan and Omicron. Because I still don't really want him to get COVID now. I don't quite know how he's going to respond. He's going to make a bad antibody profile that could give him Omicron long COVID, for example, or XB115 long COVID.
Those of us that contracted long COVID, do you think that's something that we're going to have to deal with going forward? Either for COVID or for every infection, that we are not producing the correct antibodies for these things?
Not for every infection, because I think every time you get a new infection, you probably make new antibodies to it. And if you make good quality antibodies, that won't be a problem. But I think if you get COVID again and you haven't corrected your immunity profile, then you're at risk of potentially getting long COVID for an Omicron variant.
Long COVID on top of long COVID?
Well, yeah, you get a different variant persistent in your body. I think it'd be a good idea, for example, for people that have long COVID to have Paxlovid. In the event of getting a second infection, they take Paxlovid straight away.
You can't get Paxlovid though, can you? It's very difficult.
It's hard, but through our private clinic, we're getting some. And I know some people importing it from India, which I think is wrong. We should be able to get it in the UK.
Yeah, and it's actually something that's been spoken about for long COVID patients in terms of their vulnerability for quite a while now, and there has been no progress on it, I guess because we're only just starting to embark upon trials.
Even trying to flag immunovulnerability using our spectrum test has been hard in the NHS. So we've had a couple of people we've referred through our private practice into the NHS. As a result of which somebody got an antiviral when they had an infection, Molnupiravir, but it's been very hard to raise the profile of immunovulnerable patients using our test. The NHS is not supporting long COVID patients with prophylactic Paxlovid.
We had spoken to someone very early on in our podcasting, so it was probably around July or August 2021, who had said that she was wanting to recommend Evershell because she worked with immunocompromised patients. You have actually been using Evershield. That is only going to work on the earlier variants. That's right, isn't it? It doesn't work against Omicron because it was created for those earlier variants. As things move on then, what do we do in terms of a monoclonal antibody for the next variants?
So there are some interesting trial antibodies being trialed in San Francisco, which are new. They haven't been fully regulated yet. They offer protection across the entire spectrum. AstraZeneca Evershield 2 coming out that has antibodies to a universal epitope. So that's back to my positive spectrum, universal spectrum. So they think now that they've got immunotherapy coming through the regulatory process that would address all variants so far. The spike protein has a hinge on it. When it goes into the cell, it goes on the cell receptor, it changes shape. It goes from a pre-fusion state to a fusion state. And I don't think you can mutate the hinge. If you mutate the hinge, it breaks and it won't work. So I think that's an Achilles heel. If you can raise an antibody to the hinge, it will always be there. And if you look at the maps and the papers we had, you can see that the mutations have happened in all the regions except around the hinge area. So I do think there's an Achilles heel for it. And if we get it to work now for all variants, like the Evershield 2 is working for AstraZeneca, then we may indeed have a good immunotherapy for the against the virus.
Do you think the NHS would, because they already kind of neglect the long COVID cohort, do you think there's a way to convince the NHS that this is an important thing to back?
This is hard. I've tried very hard to get long COVID patients with the test results into the consultants of the NHS. I've tried to get Paxlovid through the clinic in London, prescribed through the NHS, and that hasn't happened. I hope that when our diagnostic accuracy study happens, were it to be successful, then the long COVID syndrome would turn into a disease. And if the disease could be diagnosed and somebody like the WHO recognized it, then it can be diagnosed and therefore treated. And I think that might change the footing of long COVID in the medical community. The other good news is the Novavax vaccine is a protein. So they inject the protein in your arm rather than get your cells to make the protein using the message. And the protein hangs around for longer, and that makes good neutralizing antibodies across all variants. Now, I wonder whether there's a strategy that says we have the messenger RNA as a first responder vaccine. If a new problem came along, you can make a new messenger RNA in 100 days, and we would have a proper defense against the next attack. But why don't we then go back to a more traditional anti-vaccine, such as the protein, whole protein vaccine or a whole virus vaccine, that we've known and loved for maybe 60, 80 years, a vaccine that Jenner would have understood, for example. And it hangs around in your arm for longer. Maybe you mature different antibodies to it. Maybe you make better quality antibodies as a result. And that then, I think, is a way for maybe repairing the biomark, that repairing the gap in the spectrum that we've observed.
For long COVID patients as well, that could potentially actually repair.
The therapeutic strategy that derives from my test is that you plug the gap quickly with immunotherapy, you clear the virus from the body, and then you repair the gap with a different type of vaccine.
Okay. So when I was reading about your treatment strategy, it said that you use a strongly sterilizing serum containing the antibodies. That's the monoclonal antibody. And then is that what is plugging the immunity gap, or then you are subsequently plugging the immunity gap with the vaccine?
No, the immunotherapy plugs the gap. It fills.
Okay.
So that means you then have a very high concentration of antibodies in your body, sterilizing the virus wherever you find it.
We're not offered the Novavax here.
I mean, you can't even get a vaccine privately at the moment.
No.
And if you wanted to get a flu vaccine, you could go buy one for £20 or something. But if you're not 65 or over at the moment, the COVID vaccine is not available.
Why is that?
I don't know. There's talk next year of it being available commercially or privately. I don't know why it's not available at the moment.
My mum, who's obviously eligible for a vaccine, had one. But it was Pfizer. It was like the fifth Pfizer one she's had.
Yeah, so we don't get to choose. My parents-in-law live in Germany, and they had a Novavax vaccine. Not that they chose it, but they did have a Novavax vaccine.
Yeah.
And I think it would be good. I mean, the messenger RNA has been a bit of a gene therapy experiment globally. We've been putting gene messages into our bodies. I think it would be good to switch back to proteins. I would find it intellectually safer somehow. So again, privately, that may be something we can do in the new year.
But that's awful, isn't it, though, if that's only privately that we can offer anything to long COVID patients, to anyone that's vulnerable. There's still a massive problem in this country that long COVID is not really registered as anything. You can't get anything for having long COVID, despite it being fairly crippling for a lot of people.
In the words of Boris Johnson, long COVID's bullshit.
Yes, and now it's in the rearview mirror as well. There's just nobody worried about it.
No.
But if we can show there's a good diagnostic, then it becomes a disease. If somebody like the WHO recognise it, then maybe we have a chance.
And so that is what your test could potentially be once you have gone through the various ethical and clinical studies. You are suggesting that this could be a definitive diagnostic tool for long COVID.
That's the objective, yes. And I would then also like to think we could validate the therapy. And we're trying to get some money philanthropically to take 100 patients through the therapy. And we'll know pretty quickly whether they recover or not, whether there's a significant improvement. My problem is I then don't have a marker for recovery. What does recovery look like? Is it getting back a life, but maybe not your original life? I mean, in the patient that's on holiday at the moment, we know there's parts of his brain that are still underusing glucose. Compared to other parts of the brain. So is that consistent with his brain fog? Is that going to take a long time to correct? Have microclots disappeared from his blood? We're about to test that too. So what's a good biomarker for long COVID recovery? I don't know.
But it's so difficult because do you know how his brain was uptaking glucose before he had long COVID?
No.
Or if indeed he had microclots before he had long COVID, you don't know.
So the best option is to be your own control. I can measure you before you take the treatment and then measure you after you take the treatment and see whether there's a change.
Whether there's that change, yeah.
I mean, but there are people that I know, colleagues at the university, that have been in their bedroom for the last 18 months. They can't tolerate the light. They have truly awful long COVID. And if it were to be persistent virus, there could almost be a Lazarus cure. They might just stand up and start walking around, not immediately, but there would be a real change in their ability to cope with a life of some form.
And there's a real fear as well that the longer we wait, that the damage being done to our bodies because of if it is persistent virus, but then the immune dysregulation is then causing more and more problems to our organs and our bodies, that they won't be able to be, you know, a decent repair, or we won't be able to get back to who we were beforehand.
Yeah, and that ties in with your comment on the NHS previously, Noreen, that if it was more considered by the NHS at this stage, then people wouldn't be going so far down the path of having the almost physical scarring on their internal organs that are caused by this immune dysregulation.
And I think it depends a bit on where you have the persistent virus. So some parts of the body would repair well, but things like neurons in the brain don't repair very well at all. In fact, if they were to repair too much, then you'd lose your memories. And so there may be parts of the brain that simply don't recover well. And there may be scars on other critical parts of the body. My instinct would be if you haven't recovered from any viral infection within 3 or 4 weeks to take a test to see what your antibodies are like and then try and intervene to clear the virus. So if somebody were to get an infection now, a COVID infection now, not get better, I would suggest, not because I'm selling the test, but I would suggest intellectually it's a good idea to see whether you've made some antibodies or not.
Yeah, it's easy for us to say, right? And then people who are sick who don't know, who have no knowledge of the medical system, just wouldn't know where to turn.
Yes. It is frustrating that there's no surveillance available with the GPs. If we can raise the profile by having some success, then I think that might change.
That would be great. How big a trial are you looking? How many people are you hoping to recruit?
For the diagnostic accuracy study, we're doing 50 long COVID patients and 50 non-long COVID patients. Then we'll reanalyze the 35 commercial samples we've collected. And that will give us a good look at the diagnostic accuracy. But for the therapy trial, I would like to recruit 200 patients, measure their spectra, and then push 100 through the therapy for which we have an obvious gap in their spectrum. So if there is a gap in the spectrum, then we fill the gap and it's a clear intervention and a measurable change.
For the potential studies and therapy, are you working in Exeter? I know one of your previous studies, you were also working with St Thomas's.
At the moment, Recognition Health in London, in Harley Street, is the clinic that's helping us with it's a named patient basis at the moment. So it's the doctor looking at our tests and seeing that it adds value to the health of the patient. When the diagnostic accuracy study is done, if it looks like it's promising, then we'll push it through to a UK CE mark. And then maybe even an FDA emergency use action. If we can get those sorts of bodies accrediting the test, then I think we've changed the profile of long COVID.
Okay.
Have you two been tested?
For antibodies?
Yeah, using our test.
No, we haven't. So we just need to contact Recognition Health.
It's a mail away. We'll send something out to you. It'll come into the lab and we'll test it within a couple of weeks or so.
Okay. And from that, you're saying that we could then get fixed in terms of if we had the money to pay for the immunotherapy, your partner in Recognition Health uses the immunotherapy essentially off license on willing participants.
Yeah, so assuming we measure a spectrum with an obvious gap in it and the immunotherapy fills the gap, so there's a strict criterion at the moment, then yes, you could buy it. It's about £6,000 for all three doses and the surveillance. That's what the drugs cost. And that's why I want to get the philanthropy to cover it in the short term. Then you go through these three cycles of the drug and we will see the antibodies rise in your blood. We'll look at the changes in your symptoms. And then at the end of those three phases, we will then give you a hetero vaccine to see if that we can repair the gap.
And the test is £200. Am I right in saying that?
That's right, yes.
So actually what you're saying is if things aligned for someone, it would cost £6,200 for this.
£6,000, the total cost of the consultations, the drugs and the surveillance tests.
Okay. Which sounds a lot of money when you say it like this. Yeah. But if you consider how much the NHS spends on every single MRI, every single battery of blood tests that don't actually prove or don't actually show anything, in the scheme of things, if people could be fixed earlier on, it could actually be a money saver for the NHS in the long run if we were to go down this route.
The NHS have bought these drugs and they paid the full price for it. And I know they have sotrovimab, for example, in stock, which is a drug that I would use instead of Evusheld as an alternative to Evusheld.
Which does those earlier variants.
Yeah. Why won't they release it? If they bought it and it's basically going past its sell-by date, why would they not release it for a trial so that we could try it under controlled conditions? Now, we can do that within the private clinic. If I have the diagnostic test, accuracy test results looking promising, why don't we try and set that up in a NHS hospital? But then somebody's going to have to fund it. And at the moment, the source of funding for long COVID research in the UK is quite thin.
There are not looking like any governmental bodies willing to invest anything in this kind of thing.
I've asked the person who sits on the sotrovimab stockpile in the NHS whether we can have some, and they haven't replied. I mean, they engaged in a discussion. They said they were going to go and think about it, but they just haven't released it.
Okay.
Same for Paxlovid. We have a lot of Paxlovid in stock. It's not very expensive.
It's all going out of date as well.
Indeed. And so why don't we use it? I don't understand why there's no interest in testing some of these hypotheses.
Especially as there are so many people who are willing, essentially, to be human guinea pigs for some of these hypotheses. Those of us who have got so frustrated with the illness, there are people... I'm a little more hesitant to try certain things, but I know of people who have tried a lot of different things.
Yeah, if you're sat in your bedroom and you've been there for 18 months and you can't work properly and it's dark, then you're probably at the end of your tether now. And in the controlled environment against the clinicians watching any adverse effects and making sure that the process is looked after, and if it were to become a problem, it's ethically stopped. But the drugs are not, they are being used off license because they were intended for use on acute infection. And we're arguing that the virus is still there. And so actually the off-license part is rather small. In other words, it's still being used as it was intended, which was to kill the presence of the virus in the body. It just doesn't happen to be as part of an acute infection.
But Evusheld, when it was used, didn't have a great success rate, did it?
But they were only using one, weren't they?
There are two antibodies in the Evusheld dose. They were using them apart. We've been putting them in at the same time, as have some other people. Yes, it wasn't brilliant against some of the early variants, and I think we still carry that risk. If it turns out to be poor against beta, it doesn't seem to be that bad against beta, actually, then there would be a risk that it didn't work. And the reason I wanted sotrovimab is because it's given as an infusion, and the higher the concentration you can get in the blood, the more passes across the blood-brain barrier into the brain, which is where the brain fog is happening. So a higher concentration in the blood is better at targeting the brain problem. So there are lots of options. I just wanted to get a philanthropist to fund it. And we're chatting to Balbi, and one of the crypto billionaires is supporting long COVID research. And we have an application in with them. And if they were to fund it and they're looking at it closely, then we would go ahead with the trial quickly.
Well, that would be amazing.
Great. At the moment, should we direct our listeners to Atomarker or Recognition Health if they would like to keep an eye on those trials?
Both pages will share the results. So if you want to book the test, you have to do it through the clinicians at Recognition Health. if you go to our website, the Atom Marker website, it will have the redirection through to recognition, but it will have the results when they become available, and we'll publish it quickly. We're working in collaboration with David Price at Cardiff, and we'll pull out a joint publication as quickly as we can to show the value of the test.
Is it just one doctor at recognition at the clinic that's working with you, or is it the whole group?
There's one lead, Steve Alder, who's a neurologist and has been looking at brain fog and chronic fatigue for a long time. And he thinks this is the beginning of a bigger problem and understands its need. There are now some other clinicians at Recognition Health that are able to take the consultation and to interpret the spectra and then convey the information to the patients.
Recognition Health is quite a big organisation, is it not? Is it in the US as well?
Yeah, there's some really exciting work on traumatic brain injury and dementia. And the chief executive of Recognition Health led the donanemab trial for dementia earlier in the year that was published. They have trial collection clinics in the US and around the UK. And we're going to be doing some work on dementia biomarkers with them, which is really exciting.
Yeah, and that sounds like a strong partnership.
They're very dynamic.
That is what we need in this space, though, isn't it?
Mm.
We need people who are prepared to think outside the box, take some risks, and actually try and do something for people to actually reverse this process rather than just treating symptomatically.
Treating symptomatically as a scientist is not right. You've got to treat the cause. Otherwise, you're just sitting on the symptoms or suppressing the symptoms. It's like when you give your child a cowpole or some such, and you know they feel better for that four-hour window. But if they come out of the window at the other side and it hasn't improved, then you begin to get worried. And after three, four-hour windows, you're thinking, good Lord, is this the onset of sepsis or something? And it would have been better to have intervened earlier than to wait 12 hours and have the child get worse underneath the drug. So I think addressing the cause, and this hypothesis about persistent virus is being tested in quite a few laboratories and clinics now, and I think it does explain the symptoms. 250 long COVID symptoms reported by some people. And there must be a common cause for that. That can't be. Ideally, there's a single common cause. It could be just the proteins interacting with all the systems in our body causing havoc. But it'd be nice to think there is a single common cause which can be treated.
There are degrees, though. Emily and I, at times, were pretty sick, but we have never been as sick as some. We both have very different sets of symptoms. Mine are all cardiac and hers are all neurological. It's hard to see what is causing it if it's just a simple lack of the right antibodies clearing a virus, if you see what I mean.
Although, if you have a viral reservoir around your heart, it's 90 nanometers, it can sit between cells, it suddenly gets access into a cell, a microinformation process happens or a microclot happens, and then you clear it and it goes away for a bit and then it comes back. In your heart, it may be because you're under physical stress, suddenly your heart rate is high for a while, you take some exercise, that dislodges the virus, that produces an episode of some form. And similarly, neurologically, I mean, if it could be latent for a while, it's a fairly small volume in your brain, especially if you look at the volume of the CSF as well. Maybe something dislodges it. Who knows? It could be even a good mood, or it could be an emotional activity that triggers the firing of neurons in a particular part of the brain that triggers the interaction of the virus with a neuron, and suddenly you have a microinflammatory event.
Okay, Emily, be more zen.
Top tips from Noreen. I keep getting long COVID relapses because I'm not zen enough, which would explain why my mindfulness, my meditation and my yoga really helps me.
Yeah, indeed. Time after time in these interviews, we get told that there's no silver bullet. And you're saying the opposite, which is nice.
You're saying there's a silver bullet. That's what we've been waiting for all these months.
That's the line, right? That's the tagline now. I think there's a simple hypothesis we can test, and one long COVID patient's now on holiday. If I had done that for 100, then I'd be sitting here telling you that I have found something that works. But I need to test it. And if it goes wrong, I need to stop it. We won't treat 100 people if it's not working.
It was remarkable how Professor Shaw could talk about long COVID at so many different levels outside of his field of expertise. And I think we find that a lot with our guests, don't we? Because it's such a wide-ranging umbrella term that they have to almost kind of understand not just their speciality, but the other bits of what's going on in the body.
so many different angles to it.
If you study long COVID or looking into long COVID or treating long COVID, you almost have to be an expert in holistic healing.
Oh, and yet it feels like so few people that we ever speak to actually have an understanding of holistic healing. Really, I've found even with the functional health people that we've spoken to, a real broad understanding of what we need to do across our entire life structure. I don't know that we've got an idea of how to bring it all together properly.
No, and I don't think they do either, but I think they're learning by default.
Yeah, and you're right, that these people do end up, their knowledge base is so diverse.
And they're so confident, like Professor Shaw was, to be able to talk about different aspects of your illness, even though it's not his area of field of expertise. Because you often find people who are really expert in one area shy away.
From anything else.
From anything else. But there's this confidence that comes, I think, from a lot of learning and a lot of learning in a field that's fairly new, that allows so many of these people that we've spoken to over the last couple of years to talk in that way.
Yeah. Now, specifically relating to the antibodies and the monoclonals that we've spoken to, it's been raised by various different people. By Danny, obviously, we spoke to Michael Peluso. We still need to follow up with Tim Heinrich to see what is going on with the monoclonals at UCSF. At the moment, the jury's out, isn't it? It's an exciting area. It's a potential area. But we're still far from actually having the results to say this actually can fix you. Would you agree?
100%. And I also think that this whole area is so difficult because people make different antibodies to different strains.
Mm.
And the monoclonals only tackle
certain
strain.
And it's one of the things that you raised in the interview there. And I think something that we haven't got a full answer on is if we've got a problem with our antibody production that's then filled with one specific monoclonal for that strain of COVID, does that mean that we also have gaps for other viruses? I don't want to be depressing about it, but it could end up be that you're filling one hole with that monoclonal. But if the actual issue is that your body is unable to produce the correct antibodies to a variety of different illnesses or strains of COVID, you are once again just literally plugging holes and not dealing with what's caused that poor antibody response.
Yeah, it goes right back to this idea that people are more predisposed.
Yeah, and it's still something that we've not ever really got an answer on. What is it genetically about us that meant that we had an antibody gap or that we were susceptible to it?
Last few interviews we've done, most people have talked quite a lot about this idea of viral persistence.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the leading theory right now.
Right now.
What's your view on it?
I feel like we could be potentially honing down to a pathway in that, because of the evidence that we've got from gut biopsies and from the way that just personally you and I react to viruses. There's something going on with the way in which our body responds and deals to viruses.
For me, the jury's still out, because is that ongoing response due to the fact that we do have viral reservoir somewhere, or is it just COVID came in, messed up our immune system, or heightened our immune system because we're predisposed to having this reaction to this novel virus, and now we're in this cycle of the virus is gone but our body is now completely primed in a different way?
Yeah, and that also then goes back to this whole autoimmunity theory, doesn't it, which I don't think that you can take these things completely apart or take them separately.
I mean, Danny said it, didn't he? He said the long COVID, it's an immunological disease.
Yeah. But I do feel like some of these people are providing us with hope in the form of, let's just look, let's see what our bodies, if there are markers, if there are things that could diagnose, show what is happening to our body. I think every test or every piece of evidence that we can get is helpful. One of the other things that has been consistent in all of our recent interviews is the need for funding in this space so that we can move into large-scale clinical trials, be it on diagnostic testing or on potential treatments, because at the moment we are still always talking about such small numbers. We are always talking about such anecdotal evidence, and we need that to be amplified hugely.
You couldn't get smaller than this last interview. It was just one person, wasn't it?
One person. But you know, if I was that person that got well, then one is all I need. Join us next week as we hear others' experiences of long COVID. Share your stories and questions at tlcsessions.net. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram for the latest updates. And if you found this interesting, please do subscribe.